This podcast is sponsored by TaskTop, the leading value stream integration solution that makes DevOps work at scale. TaskTop integrates your favorite tools used to plan, build, and deploy enterprise-scale software and enables organizations to deliver better software faster. For more information about TaskTop, please visit infoq.link/TaskTop.
Welcome to the InfoQ Culture Podcast. I'm Anil Paish, and I'm the head of DevOps coverage at InfoQ.com, the software engineering website. This is the third of a mini-series of podcasts we're doing focused on DevOps. Today I'm speaking with John Willis. John is Director of Ecosystem Development for Docker and is the author of 7 IBM Red Books and co-author of the DevOps Handbook, along with Gene Kim, whom we spoke to previously in the series. Also, Jez Humble and Patrick Dubois are co-authors of the book. And John has spoken at many conferences, including our international QCons. And finally, he runs the DevOps Cafe podcast with Damon Edwards, as well as a new podcast with Mark Burgess called In Search of Certainty. John, welcome to the InfoQ Culture podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. You know, I got to say that, and you guys need to invite me back to the QCons, man. I dig that conference. I really do. I'm not just saying that because I'm on your podcast. I mean,
Thank you.
I get so much value out of going to that conference. So tell those guys to invite me back.
Very broad scope, and we definitely look forward to have you again. I mean, it's always insightful, yeah. Your talks. Just would like to ask you to do a brief introduction, if you don't mind, for people who might not be as familiar with your work.
Yeah, you know, you covered a lot of it there. I mean, I guess, I've been really doing IT operations and operational infrastructure for, getting close to 40 years, and I hate to admit. Just long history of just being around, even back in the IBM mainframe, but really been, you know, my kind of passion has always been around the data center, you know, and as it's looked over the last 38, 40 years, and as most people probably know, you know, probably around 2008, 2009, officially, this thing we called DevOps, which was really just a codification of a lot of practices, you know, from a lot of different areas. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. But I did, you know, when I heard about the kind of concept, it just pulled me in like, you know, like the sun, the gravitation. And I wound up going to the first DevOps day. It was actually a one-day thing, the first one in Ghent in 2009. I was the only American there. I was just blown away by what these young people were talking about, this kind of new way to do all of this stuff that, you know, I've been at that time probably been doing for 30 years. And it just hooked me. And I was doing a podcast with Damon Edwards, and we decided that we would try to run the first US based one in Mountain View. And, you know, put in perspective, the first one again had about 38 people, 35, maybe 40 people. 6 months later, Damon and I and a few other people ran one in Mountain View, and it was 300 people. And, it just from there, you know, I at the time I was working for Chef. I was very early in at Chef. They kind of sponsored me to kind of go around the world. I really did help kick off New York, Boston, different parts of the world. I was just, you know, an evangelist for this kind of idea, and it just, you know, got involved with Gene Kim with the book, and just been, you know, my head up to my eyebrows with this watery DevOps thing quite a while.
A lot has happened since 2009 in the DevOps space. What are you up to these days, and what's your, let's say, overall feeling about how DevOps has evolved and maybe means different things for different people today?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like any movement that becomes popular, right? Like, so, you know, you can look at the negative, you can look at the positive. I'm less concerned about the name, you know, even though, you know, I'm kind of being a charlatan because the name is what's, you know, my passion got me into this thing. The name DevOps, you know, okay, well, you know, John was one of the original DevOps guys. But, you know, so I do float on the name, but, you know, I'm okay with like, pushing the name down a little bit and think more about the practices and principles. I think digital transformation is going to come over like another wave. one of the things I want to make sure that we don't do, you know, in our industry, we're horrendously bad at throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? Like a new trend comes in and it's like, okay, well, this is, let's stop all of that. You know, it even happened, you know, going back in my history, you know, I remember when we went from kind of mainframe to distributed computing, you know, the mainframe, these large telcos and even financial institutions had very mature patterns and practices how to do data center operations and IT infrastructure, change management, change control. A la new distributed computing, anybody who talks about a mainframe gets fired, and we basically don't like learn anything from our prior art, right? And you know, and if this digital, and I do think digital transformation is a real thing, like, you know, if I'm going to yell and scream and holler, I'm going to say, let's not throw the, you know, all the good work that's been done over the last 8 to 10 years out because we think this is something like immutably new. Because it isn't, right? The practice of principles, you know, I mean, you asked me what I'm really passionate about right now is kind of cross-fertilization, less about the quote unquote DevOps. And, you know, I think we've come to the conclusion that most of DevOps comes from Lean. Where does Lean come from? Toyota Production Systems. Learning more and more that a lot of what we can learn and overlap comes from people who think about, human factors, safety, you know, resilience engineering, a guy named Sidney Decker, right? So like we're all talking about the same thing. And so I think the thing I'm really passionate about right now is to look at all these kind of, I would call them super patterns from Lean, from sociology, from human factors and safety engineering, right? And say these are common practices and principles that make sense across all of these silos.
Right. Also, when we spoke with Jin Kim, he was saying the DevOps handbook was meant to be kind of a guide and, you know, accumulate the knowledge from the DevOps Enterprise Summit, in particular, you know, the different experience that those companies had and how they're evolving their practices to kind of help guide other people. So I guess it's similar to what you're saying, to just build on the knowledge that we have and improve the practices as opposed to just a radical new way of doing things.
Yeah. No, I mean, Gene and I are both big, big fans of Toyota Production Systems, big fans of a guy named Mike Rotha, who wrote Toyota Kata. He wrote the original book on value stream mapping, learning to see, SEE. We had Steven Spears, at 2 years ago as our keynote, and you know, he was the original author of the Harvard Business Review decoding the Toyota Production System DNA. And so and we're seeing out of those case studies, a lot of those companies are either, you know, indirectly or directly through the DevOps Enterprise Summit have learned about Toyota and Lean and again on their own as well. And you know, you see a lot of the presentations and discussions. You know, even if you read the book, we talk about lead time and we break out the kind of metrics that come directly from Lean. So, yeah.
You know, obviously DevOps now is, let's say it's very kind of became mainstream and you see more and more DevOps trainings, for example. Do you think those kind of official trainings can also bring value to the industry, or do you think we should focus more on case studies and what other people have done, like, you know, like it's been written in the DevOps handbook?
I think you have to do both. You know, I think there's, you know, I mean, certainly the case studies and the continued, I mean, since the book, there's probably been another 50 to 75 case studies, maybe 100, right? So, So that are all out there on YouTube, just as part of, you know, the DevOps Enterprise Summit. This will be our fourth year going into November this year, 2017. It'll be the second London-based one here coming up in a couple of weeks. And, you know, and we produce all the videos. Right. So all of them are the only ones that don't get like put out on YouTube for free for reviewing are the ones, the companies where they're not allowed to, you know, because of their own internal requirements. So, yeah, so there's like the tremendous body of work in terms of just, you know, you can look at these companies as case studies. But then, you know, there's a place and an important place for just the rote, like, how do you do CICD? How do you do monitoring? You know, what those kind of things, right? Those are tech for tech's sake training. And so I think you need both, you know, and you need different layering. And then I think the third thing, you know, Gene and I are working on a project. It's called Beyond the Phoenix Project, where it's going to be an audio only series. And I'm not sure exactly when we'll get it completed, but it's where we look at all of the prior works that go into. So if you look at the DevOps handbook, it's about practices. It's, you know, it's kind of built around the codification of certain, a model of practices. And Gene calls it the three ways, right? The first way, left to right, second way, right to left. The first way is about flow. Second way is about kind of feedback. And third way is a continuous learning, right? So you see, we build the structure of that. And then we talk about case studies, you know, and probably about 30 of them, 35 of them are enterprises, and about, you know, I think, you know, 48 or like 10 or 12 of them are, my math is probably all off the chart here, but 10 or 12 of them are web scale. But you see these patterns and practices codified around kind of the three ways. And that's great. But again, somebody's going to have to build a CI/CD pipeline, right? So you got to kind of learn Jenkins, and you got to learn about kind of Artifactory or Nexus, or, you know, and how to glue all those things together, which, by the way, I've just completed a course for the Linux Foundation, shameless plug, on an intro to continuous delivery. So
you recorded this free course, I believe, for introduction to DevOps. So that's more technical.
Well, actually, it's two courses now. The second one actually is just coming out like this week or last week. The first one was really more of kind of across the board, everything you'd want to know. Originally, it was kind of, why don't I build a course? So the Linux Foundation approached me and said, you know, do you want to build a DevOps course? And I'm like, yeah. And the idea might have been to loosely base it off the framing of the DevOps handbook. But I had an opportunity as I was working on that, you know, the year, you know, starting at day zero of the DevOps handbook launch, right? So I could include additional videos or case studies. Plus, I decided to cover much more than what was in the DevOps handbook. I wanted to cover a lot of the base knowledge, you know, like who is Melvin Conway? Why do you hear Conway's law all the time? Just one little glimpse. I wanted to cover some of the stuff by, you know, safety, you know, Sidney Deckard, Dr. Woods, Dr. Cook, John Ospar's work. I wanted to cover a lot deeper into why is this lean thing important? What did they do at Toyota? You know, let's rip apart some of Mike Rother's Toyota Kata stuff and why value stream mapping. Although in the book we cover a little bit of value stream mapping, I went a lot deeper. Anyway, so the course was, I call it the kitchen sink of DevOps. It's like I say, if you take the course, it's 15 hours of video. If you want to take it, you know, the type A way, if you want to take the more advanced version, you watch the 15 hours of video and then you watch an additional 30 hours of video that I recommend that you watch. So 15 hours is me lecturing. And then I have pointers to about another 30 hours of presentations that I've talked about that you should go watch. Or if you want to take it the third way, which I call kind of the college education, it's well over 100 hours because I ask you to watch all my videos. Watch all the videos that I recommend, read all the white papers I recommend, and read all the books I recommend. It's well over 100 hours worth of coursework. So you get to choose what way you want. But then after that, I did a follow-on introduction to continuous delivery, which is a really hands-on lab. You build a Jenkins, you build pipelines, you do Docker flows, you do all this stuff. So that's another course that's out there right now. So I think you need all, you know, I mean, I think you need to know, like you can't just run around and say, what did that guy say? Well, who's this Melvin Conway guy? What's that all about? What's Conway's lore? What is that guy? I mean, you got to go read the prior literature. You need to basically learn how to build pipelines, and you need to, you know, learn from other organizations, which is the DevOps handbook.
I'm sure it helps to have a structured approach to for people who haven't heard about some of these concepts and these ideas and the technical side as well. What I'm wondering is, when we get into kind of learning about leadership, you know, is it possible to actually train people to become what they call DevOps leader, you know, in the classroom? Because applying then the concepts and even the technical part, that in your organization, it's when you find the obstacles, right? So then you have to build that leadership, I believe. What's your view on that?
I think the best place, so, you know, I mean, this is an early movement, right? You know, even though a lot of it is based on lean, right? So we can learn a lot from just going back and looking at what Toyota did from like 1970 to 2010, right? And then it's hundreds of books. Again, best book I've read is Mike Rothfuss' Toyota Kata. I think, but the problem is, right, we're, you know, even that model is not really well understood in kind of Western culture, Western management thinking, right? So it's very emergent across the board. So I think the quick answer is you learn by going and either reading the handbook, continue to follow the DevOps Enterprise Summit, whether you go, you know, you should go if you can, because you get to meet all these people, right? And it isn't like they're celebrities, but you just actually get to have an all-way track. So you watched, you know, Courtney Kisser at Nordstrom for 3 years in a row talk about her journey, you know, the DevOps Enterprise Summit 2015, DevOps Enterprise 14, 15, and 16, you know, and then you get to talk to her in the hallway, right? And like, how did you do this? You talked about that. So, but if you can't afford to go, then the videos are all out there. And so, you know, kind of, I'm giving a long answer to the leadership thing, but right now I don't think we've codified. We just did a podcast with Courtney. She's now at Starbucks. And Damon and I in the DevOps Cafe podcast, we asked her, like, she was phenomenally successful at Nordstrom, like did some great things. And it was kind of interesting to start, okay, how do you start over? You go into Starbucks, how do you start over? And to listen to her, that's an education unto itself. If somebody took the time to write a book to explain what she explained in that podcast, that would be a great leadership book. But right now, like, we're still, you know, we're still kind of looking at all these patterns and we're saying, well, you shouldn't be doing this, but you should be doing this. You know, and there are, you know, there's different books coming out, like the DevOps Handbook. The IT Revolution Press has a phenomenal book by Mark Schwartz called The Art of Business Value. You know, so, but I still think, you know, is there one place to go? You know, I mean, no, you're gonna have to basically kiss a lot of frogs, if you will, because it's how to get to the point where you can be somebody like Courtney or Scott Pruitt, a company called CSG, these people who like every year present at DevOps Enterprise Summit, like to be like them, there's no one book. And in fact, their paths are all a little different. I mean, Courtney basically really came up strong through the Mike Rother and Kata. And Mike Rother runs a conference called KataCon. You look at Scott Pruitt, he's a classic developer, test-driven development, acceptance test-driven development, and built a strong pipeline and delivery model from that perspective, you know, really going back to the, you know, to the Dan Nautz and the behavior-driven, all that like glorious stuff, which, by the way, I do cover just about all that stuff in my Linux course, you know, the Linux Foundation Introduction to DevOps course. So you know, I guess I'm giving like a really blowhard answer here, but the point is we're still kind of nascent in pinpointing what makes good leadership. It's like we kind of know, but if you've done the research, you start seeing the clarity. I mean, you'd kind of sent me a thing about psychological safety, right? That's a very important concept. So leadership, you know, what do you have to be kind of a DevOps? And excuse me for using DevOps as this DevOps leadership, because that's a horrible expression. But the point I want to make is the people that, you know, Gene, myself, Jez, Patrick, Damon, you know, the list could go on and on of people that we know what it looks like. We would tell you that psychological safety is the cornerstone, you know, pillar one of creating an organization where there's blamelessness, where any junior person can raise their hand and say, I think you need to stop what you're doing right now. I don't think it's going to work. You know, to create an environment where, you know, where failure is embraced.
So you're going to do a talk with Damon Edwards as well at the DevOps Enterprise Summit. Can you give us a sneak peek of what you're going to talk about?
Yeah, so last year, me and Damon did a presentation. You know, back in the early days, me and Damon used to do presentations together all the time. And then for the longest time, we kind of split off. But last year at the DevOps Enterprise Summit London, we did this faster, cheaper, how, right? Which is, you know, everybody talks about, you know, faster, cheaper, safer, right? And, you know, which is good, right? Like this is, you know, comes Adrian Krakow, you know, talked about it. And, you know, like, and it is, it has the foundation of a lot of the principles that we like, that we can go faster, we can be safer, right? We found that, like, if you, and it goes back to culture, right? Like the whole culture, we kind of were talking about leadership and, you know, how to create good leadership. It's creating a culture. And what we found is that, you know, that there are patterns of culture that are either, and this actually comes specifically from this kind of Ron Westrum cultural model. He's a sociologist, but there are cultures that are pathological and there are cultures that are generative. And there's actually bureaucratic too, but I'm going to stick with the extremes. And what we found through the DevOps survey data, through just experience, that cultures that are generative, which are cultures that have psychological safety, cultures that embrace failure, embrace, you know, when the person says, hey, I think this is broke, that becomes a learning opportunity. So they think like learning organizations. Those cultures tend to be faster and more resilient than the pathological cultures. And we have this again, survey data, we get experimental experience data, where then the pathological are, you know, failure, you know, like you get fired, you get blamed, there's blameless, there is blame, it's a blameful environment, it's the messenger gets shot, right? You know, again, as opposed to generative, where the messenger is like embraced, thank you for bringing that up, this is an opportunity to learn. Again, the data shows us, the experience shows us that the companies that are generative in culture are faster and more resilient, right? So this mantra of, you know, faster, cheaper, safer, right? And cheaper is just that we can use commodity stuff, cloud. We can, you know, we don't have to spend gazillions of dollars on hardware and infrastructure. You add all that together. And the only thing that Damon and I was saying, that's great, but like, how do you do it? Like, how do you, right, you know, I keep hearing this, and we focused on the ops side. And so this year is really kind of taking that one step further on, you know, everybody talks about the flow, you know, how do you get the flow going? We talk less about once things are in production, how do you deal with them? It's a lot what Damon does on his side. And so we were going to kind of combine, you know, a little bit of my Docker stuff in terms of, you know, we call immutable patterns of delivery, where kind of things don't get, you know, they're built immutably at development time and pass through the pipeline as immutable artifacts. You know, within a short period, I can't go into long detail on that. You combine that into how do you operate an environment scale, which is a lot of what Damon does with Rundeck and stuff like that. So we wanted to really kind of talk about, you know, what is an immutable delivered infrastructure look like, and how do you operate it at scale?
Okay. Sounds interesting. To close the interview, I would like to ask you about another topic. You have been studying a lot about burnout, and you actually spoke about that last year at QCon. Have you been investigating further on this topic?
You know, it's funny, you know, again, for people that don't know me, will make this sound like I'm full of crap. But, you know, in early 2015, a young man passed away, you know, basically committed suicide in the DevOps community. And I wrote an article, and I didn't really want to be like a prophet or an evangelist for burnout. It wasn't like I didn't wake up going to this conference where I found out this young man who I knew pretty well had committed suicide due to burnout. But what I did is wrote an article, started speaking about it, and it created this explosion in 2015, rolled over into 2016, this conversation that really started getting strong. Again, I didn't see my role as the evangelist for this thing. I thought, okay, well, this is good. This conversation has started. You know, QCon, Interop is having DevOps days. We're all having burnout discussions. Here we are now halfway through 2017. There's hardly any discussion about burnout again. And I'm saying because I dropped the ball, like I'm not trying to make it sound like I am this godlike figure that controls everybody. But the fact is, you know, going into the summer 2015 to the summer 2016, there was an absolutely rigorous, strong conversation about burnout. And this is a disease. Young men and women are dying. And I just got a little bit disengaged with that because I got kids. I got a kid graduating high school. I got, you know, work. I try to read, you know, safety, resilience, engineering and Nash equilibrium and bad equilibrium. And I take a lot on my plate. But I'm sitting here now in summer of 2017. I'm saying the conversation has seemed to have gone away.
But you think the conversation led to some changes in how people approach?
I don't know. You know, because I mean, the answer to your question is, one of the things I've wanted to do all along is do a burnout survey. There's, you know, Christina Maslach. She's the leading industry expert on occupational burnout. She has this, it's the canonical burnout survey. It's a psychometric. It's called the MBI, Maslach Burnout Inventory. I wanted to run that back in 2015. And I just never, you know, again, I put too much stuff on my plate. I read recently this young man with two kids from Uber committed suicide. Family, and you read the profile of him just screaming for help, you know, asking his friends and telling his friends, you know, like these signs that like, and so, I feel a little bit of a responsibility to try to light the torch again. And so I've been, you know, it's funny you should ask really honestly, because I've been thinking a lot about how can I get some sponsorship? Wouldn't be hard at all to actually run an industry, a kind of a DevOps within the DevOps echo chamber, a Maslach burnout inventory survey. At the very least, it raises the conversation. But probably more importantly, what the MBI does is it's really not been done in our industry. The IT InfoSec guys did a little one. But normally it's done against police officers or emergency EMT or other industries. And they have so much data that they can compare you to other industries. And, you know, and my, I think a lot of people think, oh, Joe, he's the guy down the street. What does he have to worry? Doesn't he make a lot of money with computers? You know, I think people would be shocked outside of our industry to realize our level of suicide, our level of burnout, our level of, you know, kind of cynicism and efficacy. These are actually metrics that are part of the MBI. I think people would be really shocked to realize that the Joe or Bob, the computer guy down around the corner, is in an industry that has the level of burnout that is equivalent to like firemen and doctors. And I know people would think that sounds crazy, John, but like, I think the data would show it. I think these young kids that work at Uber or Google or, you know, imagine the kid that last Amazon, the last Amazon outage where it was basically a configuration definition failure by somebody. And again, in a blameless society, blameless organization, we don't like blame anybody. It's a system. It's a systems problem. You know, why was that kid able to, I said kid because I'm an old guy, but how is that kid able to put like the wrong comma or the wrong configuration option in? Like, it's not his fault. But I guarantee you, when he saw the carnage of that outage and where it fit, I suspect that young person had some really, you know, heavy sleepless nights. And, you know, anyway, so it, 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 it,
Just to add to that, even if the organization has a blameless culture, when it has that kind of visibility, that kind of incident, and when you look at the kind of the outside world, you know, all the how that story was reported, and all you can read is human error, when in fact,
exactly. People don't understand. You know, most people, the concept of human error. You know, Sidney Decker talks about this. I know that's why I hate 30-minute podcasts, but Sidney Decker talks about human error. Version one, version two. That's not what he says. But the new kind of version of human error is we don't blame people, right? People are part of a system, but very few people, even in our industry, understand that.
Yeah.
Right. So you're right. So when everybody's trying to figure out who this guy was, I wonder who it was. You know what I mean? This person can't. But again, that happens every day. Like we got people who are running hospital systems. I tell people if somebody adds a wrong semicolon at Uber, there's a possibility that all traffic around the world stops for a couple of hours. So we are in an industry where, and even in the perfect cultures, you know, you can't. I mean, what we do can have huge impact, and can take a large burden. The person who is possibly responsible for that, it's going to get worse too. Not to get too meta, right? Imagine if people are writing the software for autonomous cars.
Yeah.
Again, in a blameless world, in a place where we've fettered out all the legal issues, at the end of the day, when a car decides to hit an old person or a young baby in an autonomous car, right, which will happen, and there will be some software that will make that decision, there will be a software developer that will know that their code was part of that decision. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know I'm getting crazy meta. The point is, I want to raise the conversation back. I've been thinking a lot about what I can do to get the burnout discussion back up on the mantle.
Right. Should be improving our systems to try to prevent those situations trying to find blame on specific person when accidents happen.
Yeah, and one of the things that Damon and I ended with, last year in our DevOps Days London was some of the more recent work Christina Maslach has done, which is this kind of work-life balance. And what's interesting about that is, again, if I had two or three lives, I would take this on full time. But the work-life balance is more about – not about an individual and what stresses them. Like is it, you know, exhaustion? Is it efficacy? Is it cynicism? Her more recent work is this work-life balance, which is there's a mismatch between the organizational culture and the person's kind of stressors. Right. And so there is no right or wrong. And in that world, you can flip the argument to say, because if you look at the things that she lists in the work-life balance, they're actually anti-patterns of DevOps. So one of the things that we had talked about at kind of the end of last year's presentation is, what if you flipped it and said, hey, you know, I don't want to bring a psychologist in here or a CEO saying, well, what do you think this is? You know, do I need to get a couch for all my employees? In other words, most people don't think psychology, you know, like our mental health is like a tier one problem, right? What if I could flip that and say that you're losing productivity, your top people, you know, what if we can flip that in that? What if you make these people more productive? And instead of being anti-patterns of DevOps, which are clearly burnout clinical indicators, what if I could just flip that so that they're positive indications, or people are following positive indications that are becoming more productive? So you can literally – I think there's a possibility of turning the burnout discussion, unfortunately, you know, why everything has to move to revenue and money in this world, but like – but that's the reality. I think there is a possibility of a conversation where you can convince people and organizations that addressing burnout actually helps you be more efficient and actually can produce more service offerings that produce more, you know, ultimately revenue, but ultimately more business value, if you will.
Well, John, thank you very much. It was very insightful as always. Thanks for participating in the podcast.